Hello, Kevin here. I hope you're safe and well. It's hard to know what day it is, but this should be a listener's questions episode. But please note, it was recorded just before football was postponed because of you know what. Welcome to the Price of Football podcast, a podcast that follows the money behind our beautiful game. I am Kevin Day, and with me, as ever, I'm pleased to say, is the Prof, the Baron, His Holiness, His Accountantship Holiness. We're getting further. Commander of the some kind of alien. You'll be an alien somewhere, won't you? I imagine.
Probably.
Yeah. How's life for you, Kieran?
Life's always good, Kevin. Always good.
For accountants, I imagine it is always good.
I'm not an accountant, I'm a teacher.
You're always very proud of saying I'm just a humble accountant.
Well, no. I found when I was much younger that whenever I went to a party and said that I was an accountant, people either walked out the room or asked me to do their VAT return.
Either way,
I ended up going home alone. I always say I'm a teacher these days.
You're not a teacher of accountant. It's the same when people say, I never say to people I'm a comedian, because they just say, you wouldn't say to a dentist, if somebody said, what do you do? You say, I'm a dentist. Oh, you wouldn't take my tooth out, would you? It's like, well, I'm at party. Your own jokes. We are driven today by your questions, and your questions are driving us to some interesting places, including Accrington, Tottenham, the key signals in the financial statement. No, Ant and Deck never get to read that. I mean, you're that exciting, do they? The start of Saturday Night Takeaway. We've got Robbie Williams, and we've got the key signals in the financial statement. I'll be dropping out for that one, obviously.
I'm sure.
Now, our first question comes from Joey. He describes himself as Fitness Trainer Joey. Hello, Fitness Trainer Joey. He's from Milwaukee in Wisconsin. He's training, he says, to become a high-priced accountant, which I believe is a tautology. You're all high-priced accountants.
there's no bargain basements.
Good luck with that, Joey. This is an interesting question, because it highlights that there are success stories out there. Because basically, Joey said, last time he was in the UK, he trained with Accrington Stanley. And he'd like to know how it is they maintain their fairly comfortable League One status on such a small budget. I mean, you're talking about a club here that, if they're lucky, will get 50,000 fans through the door a season. So this is a success story. So, I mean, I think it's worth pointing out that for all the doom and gloom we highlight on this podcast, there are clubs that are doing a good job, like Rotherham, but doing a good job and getting relegated, and clubs like Accrington are maintaining a certain level with barely any resources.
That's right. Accrington, they bring in around about £4 million a year. I think they also try to...
Including TV,
that's right.
Corporate, £4 million a year.
Yeah, and okay. they spend just over half that on wages, so they're not one of these clubs that's living beyond their means. We were talking about Aston Villa paying £175 in wages for every £100 that comes through the door. Well, you can only do that if you've got an owner who's prepared to invest huge sums. Accrington have got a tenth of the wage bill of Sunderland. In that division.
In the same division?
In the same
a
division.
Tenth?
Yeah.
Wow.
And they managed to punch above their weight. And I think this is a classic case of an owner and a manager who are both lining up in the same direction, who support each other, and recruiting players along the basis of we are a team, and having a collective will in the dressing room, and that can take you so far. If you look at Sheffield United in the Premier League, they have a manager who, you know, despite all the craziness which is turning out in terms of the ownership of that club, he's got a together dressing room. And if you remember when we had the football scout in, he said football ability isn't the first thing that he's looking for. It's attitude and willingness to be, you know, to bond in that dressing room, and that can take you far. And that's been the case with Accrington.
So somewhere like Accrington, they would, when they're looking for players, they would explain the model to. They would say, look, we can't pay you the wages, but you'll be in a decent side, you'll be in a good morale zone, we'll look after you. So they're up front with players, and so they attract players that are happy with that.
That's right. And yeah, the manager, Coley, you know, he's got an eye for that type of player. And he'll also say to the player, look, if you know, you'll get a regular game, if you're doing well, we can't afford to pay you. I mean, the wages Accrington are paying are pretty much bottom dollar of that division. You'll be spotted by a championship club because you're playing at a high standard of football before, or at least you're getting first team football, and we move on. But it's still really tough for Accrington. Yeah, they are very much a community-based club. If ever anybody follows Twitter, the Accrington owner, Andy Holt, is an absolute diamond in terms of the way that he takes on the football authorities. If you think that, yeah, the number of clubs that are getting away with pretty creative and you know, sneaky ways of circumventing financial fair play.
We had a very public spat with Gary Neville about Salford, didn't he?
He did.
Yeah.
And also he was Accrington. He was brought before the EFL because he tweeted once that coming back from an away victory, he'd bought all of the players fish and chips at a service station. And the EFL said, well, hold on, that's not in their contracts.
What?
He got hauled before them for buying them fish and chips to celebrate a victory. It's not in their contracts.
Well, whose contract is that in? I've done lots of jobs with involving contracts. I wouldn't say to my, where's the fish and chip?
Well, I think you need to look at the small print.
Are you serious about this?
Yeah, absolutely.
Because my eyebrows have gone. Forget the eyebrows. So what was the outcome of that then?
Well, he had...
A bloke can buy... Can buy his players fish and chips, can't he, if they've won a game?
Don't post it. Don't post it on social media.
What? I'm astonished.
Yeah. Now, I got to know Andy because a year or so ago...
that would have been about 30... Well, Akron, that's 30 quid. I'm talking London prices here.
Yeah.
No, that's about 75 quid London. I mean, that's ludicrous.
It is ludicrous. And I think...
So if the manager bought it, that would be fine?
Potentially, yeah, but because it had come from the club as such, it's a breach of contract. And this, I think this is very much indicative of the way that the EFL was operating at the time. The big issues, you know, the likes of Bury and Bolton
of course, some
of these very strange transactions, we'll just ignore those. But when there's an opportunity to stick the boot in on a smaller club. Andy's an absolutely great guy. I got to meet him once because I was mildly critical of their accounts.
Okay.
He contacted me and says, let's meet up and go through this. So I met up with Andy in a pub and he said, he just gave me everything. He says, write what you want.
Did he buy the drinks?
Well, I got the first round.
Okay.
Yeah, so.
That's all, the EFL were happy with that?
Well, as I'm not an employee, I'm probably okay. Yeah.
Well, that's interesting. So that's the right way to do it, then, to get in touch with you and to talk to you about these things.
And he's been superb. I did contact him this morning because I said, this trainer guy, is he in Wisconsin?
Fitness trainer Joe, he's in Milwaukee, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So I said, you've got some fans. And Andy's response was, tell them it's shit owning a football club. So
well, yeah, funny enough, Steve Parrish would probably agree with him at a higher level. What's more remarkable about the Accrington story as well is how many clubs they've got on their doorstep. I mean, before you even get to Manchester, you've got Burnley and Blackburn. So to survive in that and thrive is remarkable. So I'm really pleased that we've been able to actually talk about a good news story. Obviously, I imagine people have been turning off in their droves because they don't want to hear the good news story, but the fish and chips would have got them back in.
Yep.
I'm guessing.
It goes, I think, every seven-year-old kid in Accrington, the players go around to the schools and they give them Accrington shirts. And you think about, we were talking the other week about some other clubs that are charging 750 quid to be a mascot. This is a club which realises its position in the community.
Yeah, good. Good for them. Matt in Guildford, we talked a little bit about referees being paid recently. And Matt's asked for a little bit more flesh on the bones about other officials, basically. It's all very well saying how much referees get paid, but what are we looking at for the assistants, for the fourth officials, for the various VAR? And he's also very interested in how officials in tournaments are paid. So, Champions League, World Cup refs, are they getting paid separately?
The Premier League refs, there's some of them are on contracts, which is, I think they're 70k a year contracts, plus they get a £1,500 match fee. So you could earn around about 100 grand a year from being a referee. But if you then factor in if you get onto the UEFA list and the Champions League list, so those guys that are doing Euro 2020, who are doing the Champions League matches, I think realistically a top referee could earn $200,000 this year.
Whoa.
The new guys coming through, they won't be on a contract. It's a bit like the England cricket team. You've got effectively some guys who are central contracted. In terms of a linesman, the assistant referees...
Thank you. Thank you, Andy Gray.
The assistant referees are those who are on contracts. They're on around about $40,000 a year is the guaranteed contract. And then it's £850 a match. And I think it's £850 a match to do VAR as well.
OK, I've never understood, because in the old days, assistant referees, lines people would be referees at a certain level and assistant refs in the Premier League or the First Division. But now I understand they're only assistant refs in the Premier League. They don't referee at other levels anymore, is that?
Yeah, I think they're just so busy.
And
because the referees, I think they meet up once a fortnight, and the assistant referees, and I think they train differently. Because if you think about it, you're using a different muscle set. So therefore, they will have specific drills and specific routines. And also, what they've done is at PGMOL, they will call them into video review rooms, and they'll say, well, this is the decision. This is what you were doing. How would you have done? Would you have done this differently? And I think the assistant referees and the referees are effectively operating as separately.
Okay. Now, Tony Pugel is a man who knows the way to your heart. And Tony knows that the way to your heart is via a financial statement. This is Tony's question. As we've discussed, club revenue is broadly broken down into broadcasting, commercial and match day. But Tony wants to know, in which category does prize money fit? Is there an easy way to find it? And this is the question that I know you'll enjoy the most. What, says Tony, what are the key signals in a financial statement that a club is financially stressed? And I presume that clubs will try and hide those key signals until a forensic accountant like you wakes up in the morning with the bat signal going over the house in Sussex and you know there's a problem.
And well, let's take a look at those in turn. As far as prize money is concerned, that is added to broadcasting income.
Okay.
And the reason for that is that money is paid out centrally by the Premier League or by the Football Association. Where does the Premier League get all of its monies from? It gets all its money from Sky and BT, and so on.
So I presume prize money also includes the money you get for finishing 12th, 13th, that extra
£2 million
to play. So it's not just winning a tournament money, is it?
No. There are three or four pots of money now.
Okay. Right.
If you go into the Champions League and the Europa League, it expands even further, and we've got 10-year coefficients, and we've got various other crazy numbers which keep the spreadsheet nerds happy. So that's the first question.
I'm almost ashamed to say I feel terrible that we had a tweet from somebody who said that inspired by you he'd started to get club accounts, and I just tweeted to say I'm so sorry, mate, but which seemed to strike a chord. But we are. It's almost sad that we're inspiring a whole generation of young people to take up accountancy here.
If I was still a Catholic, I think I'd have to go to confession on that one.
See, that's another issue you and I have got. You know, you need to come back. You've got so many, for some of the stories you tell me, my God, it's like American Express. You just get out of jail free card right at the end. Just go to confession. That'll be fine. Great. So the key signals then?
Right. Well, the key signals would be, the first thing I always look at is the wage to income revenue.
Okay.
If you are spending
per hundred pounds, that's always the figure you go to.
Yeah. I think because that gives it some sort of proper context. I think from a fan's
point of view. Villa, tell us. So £175.
Villa are paying £175
per hundred pounds of income. Right.
Now in 2018, Spurs became only the third club in Premier League history. And I've got every single wage bill of every single Premier League club on a spreadsheet. Only the third club to have got...
Of course you have.
To go...
I don't know why I'm laughing. Of course you have. It's the Baroness I feel sorry for, frankly. Yeah.
They're only the third club to go below 40%. So they paid £39 in wages in 2018 for every £100 that came through the door.
Is that all?
That's right. Whereas for Palace, I think it was 78 that season.
Oh, so what would be so anything under 100 is a decent figure then?
Well, no, because if you think about it, if you're spending £98 in wages for every £100 that comes through the door, what money have you got left to stick a a stamp on an envelope to put petrol into the mower to cut the grass.
It's better than 175.
It's better than 175. Now,
so we've got 22 quid left out of every 100.
Yeah.
So.
UEFA have a red line.
Do they?
Oh, yes. Yeah. And UEFA's red line is 70. And what they say is that if there's any clubs in Europe that are over 70 who are in UEFA competitions, they will investigate those accounts with more due care and attention because they feel that club's at risk.
Hi, I'm Steve Lamack, and every week I'm joined by Music Allies Head of Insight, Stuart Dredge, on The Price of Music, the weekly podcast all about the money behind the music industry. In each episode, we discuss the very latest goings-on in the music business and dig into the finances behind the big stories.
So whether you're a music lover who just wants to know more about what really goes on in the industry, or you're an aspiring musician, manager or label owner who wants some inside knowledge on how Spotify's financial model really works, or what the future holds for independent live music venues, this is a show for you.
Subscribe to The Price of Music in your podcast app now. See you soon.
Oh, so if Villa were to get into
Villa.
So if Villa had won the Carabao Cup, UEFA would be investigating.
Because under UEFA rules, you're only allowed to lose 30 million euros over 3 years. If you think about it, that Villa lost 68 million in 12 months.
So that's actually UEFA doing their job then, in a way, isn't it? Trying to safeguard, looking at the wages.
Yeah, and I think UEFA do come in for a lot of stick, but. Certainly, my understanding is that their team of investigators, the guys that wear the underpants outside of the trousers, they when they go around, they know what they're looking for.
They're kind of giving themselves away a little bit if they're doing that, aren't they? I'm not an expert, but surely just look out for the blokes with pants. You don't even go on Stoke. And so that's the main key signal would be the wages then, if you're looking at it.
There would be that. And the other thing I would be looking at would be debts. Now, there's two types of main debts that I'd be focusing on. First of all, how much money do they owe to banks, which could be called in at any minute? And secondly, how much do they owe to other clubs for unpaid transfer fees? We were discussing Manchester United in one of the other podcasts, and we said United owed over £250 million at one stage. You can't continually buy goods on credit, and that's on personal finance as well as football finance.
Okay, well, it's occasionally we segue seamlessly into another club because you mentioned Spurs. Gavin North, who I assume is a Spurs fan, he's been talking to other Spurs fans. It's always a good thing to do.
Well, it's better than fighting the players.
It is, exactly, yeah. It's my brother. They've been talking about, a lot of Spurs fans talk about the owner at Tottenham, and it's very difficult for me as a non-business person to see whether it's a good business model or not. But the Tottenham owners don't or haven't put their own personal money into the club. Is there a scenario where they could just pump money in and then that debt for equity would be a way around FFP? And I think I should be congratulated for reading that as though I understood any segment of it,
right?
Which I didn't.
The way that FFP works is as follows. In the Premier League, a club can lose £15 million over 3 years.
Yeah.
But if the owner sticks money in, the first £90 million that they stick in counts towards FFP.
Right.
So could Spurs spend more money? Yes, they can. Do they need to? Well, Spurs are actually making profits. So Spurs have actually got quite a bit of wiggle room in terms of what they could do. It's not a way of getting around FFP. It's actually embedded in the rules. So, yes, the Spurs owners could invest more money in the club should they choose to do so.
OK, well, this next question is about, again, was seamlessly into another question. It's almost like we've got a producer. He's actually here with us today.
He is.
Which is a sign that there might be something important happening.
He's sitting in his gold chair outside.
Of course
he is,
yeah. Yes. He's in the room with us. That's nice, anyway. Notice how the rain didn't fall on his head. It's strange, that, isn't it? We were getting soaked, and somehow he just dances through the raindrops. I think this is a good question about FFP from Stuart White. His question is, why does it take so long to bring in FFP charges and then penalties? If accounts are filed, because we know this is your favourite time of year, this is Christmas for you, because accounts are filed around March and April. This every day is an advent calendar door being open for you this time of year. Surely it should be easy enough, Stuart says, to assess any rule breaches quite quickly when the accounts are published. So his point is, I think it's a good one, rather than a conspiracy for you. Did the AFL try and avoid timing it so a team's put into relegation trouble with any points deduction or massive fine?
The EFL are trying to improve things. What clubs have to do now is that they need to stick the accounts for the current season effectively in at the end of December. So the EFL will have seen the accounts before we see them in terms of what's being released to the public. And what the EFL do, ultimately, they're trying to monitor 72 clubs.
Yeah.
So therefore, that they will look to see, well, on the face of this, these 12 clubs need further investigation, and they will direct their attention there. So there is nothing to stop now the EFL from bringing in sanctions to a club during a season itself, as opposed to the following season, which is what we've seen historically in respect of the charges made against Derby and Sheffield Wednesday.
So they're not actually looking to time it in a certain way to bring penalties in.
Well, if they've had the account, if they now get to have, they get the accounts for the season, they say, well, this is what we've done for the first 4 or 5 months, this is what we're projected to do for the next 4 or 5 months.
Okay.
If we think that there's something of a cause for concern in any of those, we could potentially bring in sanctions at an earlier point.
Right, OK. Now, the final question, and again, I'm afraid if you can keep this brief, although this is a self-imposed time limit, so we've got other pods to do, haven't we?
Yes.
Price of football pods, I should hesitate to say. You haven't got the other accountancy. You're angling an accountancy pod, which isn't going as well as the football finance and accountancy one, but you're still doing it. Gary Spencer, on the face of it, it's a very big question, but he makes a specific point to it. It's how, basically, Gary wants to know how Brexit will affect League One, League Two, and National League clubs. We've focused a couple of weeks ago on how it might affect Premier League clubs, and we'll be talking in our next pod, our long-awaited Scottish special about how Brexit will affect Scottish football in particular. But he uses the example for Notts County. So Notts County, he says, have got European players who will never be capped by their country. They're not at that sort of level. So will they just simply be asked to leave in January 2021? And if so, what happens to their contract and their resignation? Or can they apply for settled status? Because his point is that it seems like there's going to be a big short-term shock for a lot of clubs in the lower leagues, when they could potentially be losing 3 or 4 players from their squad overnight.
The simple answer is yes. I think what the clubs will argue is that if a player is signed a 2-year contract, then they're obliged to employ them to the end of the season. Because we're now moving under Priti Patel's idea of this 70 points that you have to earn, a lot will depend upon whether the EFL and the Premier League manage to persuade the Home Office that a job offer from a football club is from an approved employer, and that will account a lot towards it. The player will have to be able to prove to be able to speak English. You just hope that this is not being reciprocated elsewhere in Europe, because with no due disrespect to any of our players that are going to play in Germany and Finland and so on, we're a pretty crap nation when it comes to linguistics.
Yeah, and you also think as well that a club like Notts County won't be able to afford the lawyers that Man United or Man City can afford, for example, to find the loopholes. And I say this next bit with some reluctance, because I think my views on what I'm going to call the disaster of Brexit are perfectly clear. But in the interest of balance, I think we should point out that it could possibly be a good thing then for younger English players, couldn't it? I mean, the fact that a club like Notts County has to release, if they do have to release 3 or 4 European players who are, by definition, not the best players in the world, could mean there is an opportunity for English players from lower leagues to step up and take their place, which is a good thing. We'll have a knock-on effect on English football later on.
Yes, young English players will certainly be able to command a premium, I think, in the transfer market and the wage market. So therefore, there are benefits to them. If those players then use the opportunity of starting off at a lower league club and they prove to be better than expected, they can then further their careers. So could this have a knock-on impact in terms of the England Football Club? In theory, yes. In my view, given if you look at the way that the larger clubs recruit in terms of players at a young level, all of the good players are already at the big clubs, so I don't expect much of a difference there.
Right. Well, Gary, thank you for that question. I suspect Brexit is going to be something we keep talking about as long as this pod keeps going on. I think it's done and dusted on your angling pod, though, isn't it? I think Brexit's not carp-related Brexit problems.
Well, it depends, if the fish need a blue passport or not to be caught.
I don't want a blue passport. The fish can have my one if they want one. I'm not going to mutter that. I'm going to say out loud, the fish can have my blue passport if they want one. Gary, that was a good question. Our Monday pods are based on your questions, so if you have questions for us, It's questions@priceoffootball.com. And as ever, The Price of Football is a Dapdip production.
Thank you very much.
The Price of Football.
You're welcome.
The Price of Football.